Don't Blink, Season 9, Episode 10, Face the Raven.
Hello, sweetie. Welcome to Don't Blink, a fan podcast dedicated to Doctor Who. Grab your bow ties, 3D glasses, and sonic screwdriver, and come along for some timey-wimey adventures across the Doctor Who universe. And now, here are your hosts, David and Jeremy.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Jeremy.
And I'm David.
And we're discussing the 10th episode of Doctor Who's 9th season, Face the Raven. And I think we certainly did face a raven of sorts this week, huh?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, my goodness. Also, I will apologize to our listeners. The microphone that has served me so loyally throughout this season of Don't Blink and the previous one has decided to face its own raven and expire. So do not adjust your do not adjust your stereos. If my sound quality is a little poor, I apologize. This was quite an episode, though. My goodness.
Yeah, we had a lot to deal with this week. I think we kind of knew what was coming just with the name of the title. If you know anything about literature, ravens tend to be death. It's kind of like the Ace of Spades, I think, in that they're the harbingers of death, if you
will. Yeah, it was a little bit like when you know that there's a surprise birthday party planned for you, but you sort of have to play along. Yes. It was a bit like that. Like, you knew where this was going. But also, I should point out that we're recording this on November 23rd, which is a significant day for Doctor Who fans. It is the 52nd anniversary of Doctor Who.
Wow, we're already at 52. We just celebrated 50.
I know. I'm already getting nostalgic about it, too. I think a lot of people are. Yeah. There was a really good interview with Stephen Moffat that was in the Radio Times this morning, and we should put that out on our blog. But he looks back on Day of the Doctor, and it's kind of interesting to see how it was put together. And it was all quite last minute. You wouldn't know watching it. It looked so slick, but... Yeah, so today is Doctor Who Day, and I wish you a happy November 23rd, Jeremy.
All right, yeah. Happy Doctor Who Day to you, too.
for Kennedy aficionados, this is a bad time of year.
But. Yeah, is that the 23rd or 22nd?
22nd, yeah.
All right, well, speaking of 22nd, we have nothing to do with that. So our host ratings this week, David, what did you give this week?
I went back and forth, and I liked it more as with last week on the second viewing. So I'm giving it eight ominous birds of yore.
All right. I couldn't think of another word for a raven or any way to put that. So I gave it 9 midnights dreary. It was kind of a dreary Saturday night for the obvious loss.
So. Well, but I live in Baltimore at the moment, and Baltimore is one of the adopted homes of Edgar Allan Poe. So. I feel like this is a town where drunks come to die. We also have Dorothy Parker's ashes among other people. So,
wow, that's awesome. Okay, I don't really know how to go from there.
Actually, it's funny. I was never a Poe fan until I moved to Baltimore, and there are a number of Edgar Allan Poe impersonators and reenactors.
Yeah, you told me about.
But you know, you really have to see that stuff, I think, performed rather than read it for me to get mm-hmm. the sense of how it works. So, and of course, we've got the Baltimore Ravens. They're so named after Poe.
Mm-hmm. Are they really named after Poe? Is that why they adopted?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I used to work with them, so. Wow. This is one of the first Thanksgivings that I don't have to stand on a very cold football field.
Nice. Well, happy Thanksgiving then. You can have a different type of bird.
Exactly.
If you want to eat one, it's up to you. But yeah, I'm familiar with Poe. I didn't like him in elementary school and middle school. I learned to appreciate him once I actually got into college and started understanding literature and writing a little bit more. So... A little bit happier with him than I was when I was having to study him on my.
You know, I feel like this is another one of the episodes in season 9 that was, you know, a couple of jack-o'-lanterns away from being a Halloween episode, because that's all it really takes. But it felt like a sort of, you know, it could have been a super spooky one. But I don't know. I mean, so 9 out of 10 is a strong rating from you.
Yeah, and I think I give it a 9, maybe not for the acting and for some of the things that went on, but with the resolution of the story that we kind of got. And I say resolution, it's not resolved necessarily. I think we'll get into that in a bit, but I think they did a good job of tying those ends together. So it got a high rating for me on that. If I had to exit, or excuse me, if I had to rate companion exits, I think like the Amy and Rory, that would have been a 10. It was really strong and impactful. And I think I might have been a little moist-eyed on that evening. But this one I saw coming. It didn't bother me, but it definitely was something I enjoyed overall.
Yeah, I thought that to me, I would almost put this with something like Doomsday, where the episode to me wasn't very interesting, but the exit of the companion at the last sort of minute kind of made it what it was. And I know that Twitter just blew up over this. Like, a lot of people were very sad about, and it was a rough exit. I got to tell you, she didn't, you know, go in quite the way I thought she did. So. Yeah,
she actually, I think, went pretty much exactly how I thought she would.
So we'll talk about that in a few, but
yeah.
So this was, to talk about the cast and crew, this was written by Sarah Dollard, who, I don't know who that is.
Yeah, I was looking up her IMDb credits. This is her first Doctor Who episode. She's written an episode of Being Human, as well as a few of a show called Neighbors, I was thinking you might be familiar with. But there's not a whole lot of other writing credits. She did have some experience listed as a miscellaneous crew, and she produced a few episodes as well. But this seems to be one of the few in her writing repertoire. So it'll probably take her place.
That was Neighbors, as in the Australian Neighbors? Really?
Yes. She is an Australian, I wanted to call her a playwright, but...
I don't think writing for Neighbors qualifies as being a playwright.
Yeah, screenwriter, that's it.
So. I was going to say something absolutely terrible, which I probably shouldn't say, but... supposedly, this is of some small interest, because I grew up with Neighbors. That was on when I was a kid. They used to show it in the UK at like 5:30 in the evening. And supposedly the UK transmission of Neighbours has finally caught up with the Australian Neighbours, which is actually kind of a significant moment in sort of world culture.
Well.
We're now meshed. We're now meshed. And a celebration they give one of the Neighbours writers, a Doctor Who, a key Doctor Who to write.
It definitely was key, and we kind of mentioned already it could have been a Halloween episode, but this one was rated TV-14. I seem to notice that when it was on the screen this week. Sometimes I don't, sometimes I do, but it would pop up between commercials this week, so it was very clear that they were trying to go with a bit of a darker type tone, I think.
Now, for our British listeners, and also for me, what does that exactly mean, TV-14?
14 recommended. It's essentially a PG-13 movie. Mm. So 13-year-olds for movies, 14 for TV. I don't know. It dealt with death. I think they kind of wanted to put that on there because of what it dealt with. But other than that, there wasn't really anything scary other than the bird piercing you and sucking out your soul, which could be kind of scary to 12-year-olds.
Well, I think it was a death scene. I mean, it was, you know... But yeah. I wonder if in hindsight we'll not look back, you know, when we're in our sort of rockers, you know, on a porch when we're both 90, and we'll look back on season 9 of Doctor Who and season 8 as well as the sort of the dark ones, the ones where they, you know, because obviously Capaldi is not necessarily a friendly doctor for younger people, and also that the storylines have been sometimes so out there. You know, it's not Torchwood exactly, but, you know, the finale of last year's series was pretty intense. And I think that we'll probably, in hindsight, view these ones as, you know, when it went really dark.
I look forward to that. That'd be interesting, the hindsight there. But now, our director this week returns from last week as well, Justin Malotnikov. I'm not going to go into his background. We went into that last week. And then the actor we did last year, Joyvan Wade, he's returning from the episode Flatline.
Yeah, and very welcome he is too. I like that character a lot, and it was sort of, it really humanized it, because you've got such a big important story happening in the Doctor Who narrative, and to have someone in the middle of it that really doesn't know, you know, up from down when it comes to all of the Doctor universes was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
almost reminded me of bringing back in Closing Time when we bring back the James Corden character who we saw in The Lodger with Matt Smith. Like just a really ordinary person sort of put in the middle of something. It kind of puts it all into quite a sharp perspective.
Yeah, that was actually a funny episode. This was not
a barrel of laughs.
But yeah, we started off from the very beginning, and I'm thinking, we all know the title, and I think the very beginning, they're walking into the TARDIS from one of those, you don't know exactly what they did, but they're giving you some clues, and she's talking about how, I told you it'd work, I totally saved your life, I knew you'd be impressed, or something like that,
and you just... You look at that and you think you're so dead. Yeah,
you're wearing red right now, Clara. So that's essentially how it was. She just put on the red shirt this episode.
Oh, Doctor, let's stay together forever.
Yes. And I would get into it later, but I think now's a good time to point it out. But when she's hanging out of the TARDIS, looking for the clues, she's just reckless. I think is what they call it later. Why do you have to be so reckless? And that's exactly what she did. And yeah, it was very clear from the very beginning of this episode that she was marked for death.
It was also the Doctor's reaction to that was very interesting when she's hanging out the TARDIS. He says, yeah, this has become a problem, but it's sort of not really done in a joking way. Like it's actually, you get the sense that he really, really knows what's up. And the psychology behind it isn't, it's set up here and it isn't explored to death later on, which I quite liked. But the idea is that she probably, you know, she talks about Danny Pink later on.
Yes.
And you really do get the sense that there's the same coin has two sides, one of which is thrill seeking, the other is self-destruction.
Yeah.
And you do get that. It's very subtly done in this episode that she is almost deliberately being self-destructive. Mm-hmm. And the Doctor knows it too. But she's got this like joie de vivre or like a joy for life on the surface of it that he sort of doesn't want to unpick. But, you know, maybe a doctor that was better with people and was more empathetic would have kind of clicked into that. Like, I feel like Tennant would have just like let her out of the TARDIS immediately at that point and said, don't come back. But Capaldi doesn't quite understand humans in the same way. So he sort of lets it ride. But she's definitely on a one-way track when you see her hanging out like that.
Yeah, and we saw that in Under the Lake, I think at the end of that, where they're running through the halls, the water fills up between them, and then they get separated, and she makes a couple comments. I think one of those is, we'll be fine, the Doctor always saves us. It's very, she's almost kind of trying to not unveil what she's hiding deep down beneath it. And yeah, it'd be interesting if we wanted to assign that fate to her, the one that she was seeking death out without actually pursuing it, but just kind of subconsciously going after it. I don't know, but she did give Rigsy the TARDIS number. I don't know why she gave that to him.
Yeah, or when. I can't remember. I mean, maybe it was at the end of Flatline. I don't remember the episode that well, but
it might have been.
But it's a nice enough way to start the episode off, you know, and I sort of quite like the Doctor being grumpy about who... I didn't tell you could give that out. I like that.
Yes, yeah. Well, we kind of had that funny gag about the tattoo. It's not an emergency. It was very humorous. And you see a lot of times in writing and in TV and whatnot, I've said this before, that when there's something funny happening, typically it's weighed by something that's not going to be funny. So they'll give you funny ha-ha episodes. So when they give you the dark episodes, you appreciate the difference, the contrast, and you kind of have that in this episode. It's setting you up. You know that something's not right, something's amiss, and she's acting a little too jovial. So what we see there is setting up what we're going to have contrasted later in the episode, and we've already kind of hinted to that.
Yeah, although, I mean, I think one thing that we haven't talked about is, you know, Moffat had said in interviews before the series started that he was interested in kind of playing around with viewer expectations. So, you know, he would do two-parters where you didn't expect it, or things that you would think would be a two-parter. Yeah. So it's very unorthodox to not only kill a companion, but to do it like in the sort of the third to last episode of the series. It's, you know, I think he probably, I don't know if he was hoping it would be a shock or not. That was one thing I wasn't quite clear on. Again, going back to the surprise birthday party thing, but.
Right. I hope there's something coming, but we'll get into that. Just in a moment. I don't know. So we transition from this emergency, this introduction to the credits, and then we get to this scene with the baby. More funny at the beginning of this episode. Did you make this human? I thought that was good.
Yeah. It's still sort of reminding you of who Capaldi was, especially in the last series, who was very sort of awkward. And he's a bit more approachable this year. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see these sort of little odd moments. I have to say that there's a shot where you see the TARDIS materialize from the street. And you look up to the council flats, and you see the light kind of flashing on the inside of the through the window.
Yeah,
and it's the most unconvincing thing. Like it's like that's like classic Doctor Who, or almost like a fan movie. You know, it's like it doesn't. It's clearly someone turning a light on. It's way too bright.
Yeah, it's not working.
But bless, I sort of like that.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't as brilliant as the baby. The doctor made a comment that this baby's brilliant, and he speaks baby. We know that. I'm wondering why he's saying that. I don't know if this is a sign of maybe the next companion that he's going to pick up 20 years down the road or anything like that. It'll be interesting.
There was a casting rumor flying around today, which would tie in very much with your theory. So, and that was one of the mooted storylines for season 27 of Doctor Who, which if it had ever been made, it wasn't, because it was cancelled with season 26, was that you would see in the first episode of the series a baby or a kid, and then the next story, that kid would come back as a girl in her early 20s and would be the next companion.
Yeah, and we did kind of see that with Amy Pond.
In a way, but in a more compressed way. But this is like a season, which I think would be kind of fun. In fact, the more I've just convinced myself that that's what's going to happen. So, well, that would be a great idea. Right. I would love that.
Yeah, it could be fun for sure. So, I don't know if I really want to get into casting decisions because it's kind of a spoiler. But I don't know. I mean, we're spoiling. We're just spoiling for a rumor. That was bad. So, it was bad, but it wasn't as bad as the tattoo.
I mean, what would you think if you had a tattoo that was counting down? I mean, I'd be concerned by it, but I wouldn't assume. I'd be curious to know what would happen.
If something is counting down on my body, I'm assuming everything I've learned from sci-fi. Chronolock is a good name for it. So I don't know.
Go about my day. I wouldn't be too.
Oh, maybe when it reaches zero, the turkey will be done. Let's go eat.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tattoos normally don't count down for unknown purposes. So yeah, I'd be worried. I think it's fun that it's not boring to the doctor. That's again kind of humorous there at the beginning, but it just kind of felt weird. I bought it later. See, I like the Shielder's tattoos better than the one on the neck. But
remind me, which are those?
Well, there was the scroll work. It was just prettier.
Oh, we see. Right. It's a very prosaic tattoo, isn't it, on the neck? Like,
yeah. But they run off to figure out what's wrong with Rigsy, and they don't take the new human. I thought that, again, was another humorous part that's telling us something. And then they try to figure out what's happened to him. They check out the cell phone. They do like a body scan, and they find out that his phone has been wiped, apparently. It doesn't have any knowledge of the last day. And then the doctor kind of does the scan thingy on him and figures out that he's going to need some cue cards.
Yes, it's good to see the cue cards back again, but yes. You know, when they come out, it's never good.
Yeah, I didn't catch exactly what was on this one. I did, but I didn't write it down, and now I forgot. I was thinking, oh, I'll remember that, but he does pull that out. So, sorry, there's nothing I can do. There's no easy way to tell someone that they're going to die, I think is something like what he actually ends up saying. Which you see in the trailer, because I caught the trailer right before the episode started, because it was on my DVR, unfortunately. But yeah, you have this statement that there's no easy way to tell someone that you're going to die. But I don't know, another foreshadowing, perhaps.
Yeah, I need to start carrying cue cards around.
I thought you had.
You know, I'm just looking at a screen cap now. One of them says, I could be wrong. Let's try it your way. So he's obviously leafing through the cards. It's always funny when the cue cards come out, but it's a very interesting look that Capaldi has on his face when he kind of, you know, he walks away from the situation and says, you know, I can't do anything about this. And then is talked into sort of saving it. And I almost, this is one of those interesting things. If you think of the scene, you know, he's almost walking out of the TARDIS door and there's a long shot on his face. And then he's like, no, no, we can fix this. We've got 200 minutes or whatever the speech is. And it's one of those interesting moments because the mood is entirely carried by the incidental music. It gets very kind of, I am the doctor-y when he says that, you know, like, and I will fix this and I will solve it. And it's like a very kind of like, sort of, you know, glorious moment, but they could have easily scored it the other way where it was like really ominous. And it was obvious that he can't do anything, but he's going through the motions because that's what he thinks will be comforting to people.
Yeah. I don't know. He's the doctor. He can always win, you know. That's kind of.
I thought so last. I thought so last week. I don't know.
Yeah. This week, I'm not sure anymore. But he has that kind of knowledge that we've learned earlier this season. If we didn't already know that he's just sure of himself. So if he says that he can do it, I tend to believe that he can do it. But his idea is to find out what maps tell him. And I'm surprised they didn't just go to the internet, but they actually went to an old school library for those maps.
I feel like that could be a valid place to go. I'm not sure that they would have. I don't know. I'm not sure anything would be online. So they talk about the trap streets. I knew them actually as bunnies, which is another way to describe them. Yeah, I remember I used to work at a bookshop and we had a bunch of maps come in that had to be recalled for that exact reason, genuinely, because they had those trap streets on and someone got caught. But they used to call them bunnies, I guess, for bunny trails, where they would, they would genuinely put in like a little like cul-de-sac or a crescent or something that wouldn't mislead you or take you out of your way, but was just obviously not there. So that is a real thing.
Yeah, I'd heard of them in similar fashions as well. There used to be an old video game, actually still going around, called Eve, and people would do something kind of like that, but it wasn't. But I don't know, I was familiar with that style of mapping. Just how you would make it to where it was obviously yours, and then somebody who copied it would definitely be caught. But I'm surprised that it actually happens in the real world. So your story is interesting.
It does, yeah, it really does.
And the doctor seemed kind of stunned when Clara calls it a trap street. She's like, it's a trap street, and he's like, what did you say? Is that a clue?
Well, of course, yeah, absolutely. It works on both levels. But I think it's also that like she. I mean, she's just way too full of confidence. Like, she's got that bit of information, and it's like, so, and I think it goes back to the end of the last series where she kind of takes on the mantle of the doctor, and, you know, and she can't let it go. And it's sort of gone to her head in a little bit of a way. So now she's here giving out the information, thinking that she's, you know, that she's the doctor, and she's not, and she's just, heading for a fall that I think the doctor can kind of see too, which is part of the reason for that look. You know, I almost feel like he's hoping he can get her through this one, you know, and then have the talk with her, but he never quite is able to. Right.
Now the BBC had released something in the past. It kind of goes with what you were saying, and I think I may have mentioned it, but it was along the lines of Clara has tried to be the doctor. She's taken on that role, and now it's going to catch up to her. And we see exactly that in this episode. And I think, like you said, this was kind of a clue to what was going on. So she steps out of line, she steps over that line, and the doctor is just kind of going to have that talk. Well, we'll have it next, but he doesn't get that chance. Maybe he's meant to do that for the last two seasons. I don't know, but he doesn't get that chance this week.
No, he doesn't. And unfortunately, I also sort of, one of the things I like about this episode is that she doesn't do that in a grand sort of like season finale type way. It's not like she's facing down an army of Daleks saying, I don't have a plan and it frightens you. It's in a side street in the middle of nowhere. And she does a very tiny thing. But it's just, she's not the doctor. Like, it's not going to work. And, I like the mundanity of that. What I didn't like, and I think we can talk about that now, is the trap street and this sort of the Harry Potter factor to this sort of alternate reality that's nestled away in the middle of London.
Okay, I was thinking I might be the only one that caught the Grimald Place thing here.
Well, I don't know what that is. See, I'm not really a Harry Potter reader, and I'm quite envious of people that are. But when I was a younger man in the late 90s, when Harry Potter came out, it unfortunately became really trendy for, like, I want to use a more polite word than douchebags, but it became, it was the douche.
That's all we got.
It was a trendy thing for people to, like, read conspicuously and obviously and boastfully read kids' books. And it just wound me up so much. And I was studying literature at the time, but people were like, oh, look at me, I'm reading Harry Potter. Can you imagine how diverse I am in my, and I just, oh, it just made my skin crawl. And so I never got into it. And I suspect I would love it, but that ship has sailed like 15 years ago. So I don't know what a Grimwald place is.
Okay. It's in Harry Potter, it's a house that Harry stays in, or apartment, I don't know, that at one point belonged to Sirius Black, who's his godfather. Long story short, it can hide from normal people, aka muggles, as well as other people that aren't supposed to see it. So it was kind of the same thing to me here, and it really reminded me of that, because we get them trying to go through the streets, counting steps, and remembering the number 82. Again, remember that, because it might be important next week. Not sure, but I'd just be careful, and let's just remember 82. We have this interesting discovery of the phone data, what's going on, and then we see this place that we had already overlooked, which was very similar to what you might find in a Harry Potter or something like that. And the alley itself,
right,
that they go into felt like something called Diagon Alley.
Yes.
In Harry,
yes,
Potter.
Now I do remember that bit, because I saw a bit of the film, like, and it's that classic, like, shot where it's,
yeah,
and it sort of looks like a Dickens adaption. And I remember in that scene, a witch sort of walking by that was quite cute with black lipstick, and that was J.K. Rowling. That's the only thing I can remember of that. But in the film, like, when you first see it, it's like, but it's that sort of crane shot, you know, it's like in lots of interesting, colorful kind of things walking by. And I felt that, yeah, this was like, it didn't quite have a scale that, like, I felt that the way that they shot it in Who was really the same set, sort of photographed from the same angle, like a bunch of times for the rest of the episode.
Yeah, it did feel that way. Even when they're running through different alleys, it felt like the same alley, just with slightly different decorations. The alleyway also reminded me of the snowman.
Mm.
I didn't know if this was one of the same sets that they used for that episode. It just kind of felt like we had been there before. I couldn't really peg it in any pictures or anything, but it had that feel that we had seen with the, I guess, the second Clara to die.
The second Clara, yeah. Well, it's interesting, because back in the classic run of Doctor Who, the one thing that the BBC could do really well on a budget was Victorian England or any kind of period stuff. You know, that's all of the, if you look at the great 1970s BBC dramas, they were all period stuff, and they had all this stuff in storage. And it would be beautiful. And it was only when they tried to do science fiction, it looked horrible and tinfoil. So it's kind of funny that you go forward to 2015 and this show's got so much money and they're just, yeah, trying to do a basic Victorian street. And to me, it didn't quite convince. And the whole thing at this point, like from this point in, from the episode to the end, it felt very sort of magical and slightly vague in a way that I don't think is Doctor Who at its best, which is why I gave it a lower rating. And I love that whole gaslight thing. I think that's fantastic. But at this point, we're in this weird, like, Harry Potter land. And it's like the writer doesn't quite know what Doctor Who is. So you've got these weird magical things like chronolock tattoos and ravens and sort of, I don't know.
Yeah. And psychic worms that make light.
Yes, also true. Yeah.
Yeah, it had a magical feel, almost a Sherlocky feel as well. It kind of felt like a mystery was beginning to unravel. When they were in London regular, I guess I'll call it, running around with Riggsy, it felt like Flatline. It had the same exact feel from that episode he was in last season. And they pull you into this magical world of the 1800s, and it just, it feels, or maybe late 1800s, early 1900s, it just has a different feel. Very Downton Abbey-ish.
Yeah, you know, and there are a few streets that actually do still look like that to this day.
Oh, wow.
And they're incredible to see and a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But I felt that at this point it sort of started, it felt very diffused, and it didn't quite, like the stuff that they were saying didn't really tie into any sort of reality or physics or anything like that. And that's, I found that harder to relate to a little bit, especially when you kind of have a sense that a companion's going to die. You're like, where is the sense of consequence of this?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we're going to see more of that explained next week with May or Me, aka a Shielder. What she has done, I'm really kind of rooting for her to be killed. I mean, hey, we can finally see Arya killed.
yeah, exactly.
But I'm pretty mad at her right now, and it's like she's still responsible for that death, whether or not she wants to claim it or not. She summoned the doctor by using a deadly soul sucking weapon, and I think that's still on her shoulders. So I think we're gonna see some resolution to that a bit, hopefully, maybe. When they meet early, the three of them are trapped by the little neat locking mechanisms on the cobblestone. The mayor makes the same comment we've seen before, just with the she knows who Clara is, but she doesn't even know her own name. And I think it's very interesting. It's very telling. I think something is still going to happen, because a Shielder makes Clara important by remembering who she is. I don't know what's going to happen with that, but it feels like we're not finished with that bit just yet. But maybe we are.
Yeah, I would gently disagree, because I feel like they were setting up the last scene, which was a great scene when the Doctor is sort of not threatening her, but threatening her.
And because I'm not saying, I'm just
I'm
saying.
Not saying, I'm just saying. Because she, like, that was they both in that last scene acted so well. And I feel like it, that sense of, we'll use the word dang, where she's like, oh, dang. She knows what's gone wrong. And I think that's what they're setting up, where she says, I remember you. And actually, it was Moffat loves playing with memory. Like a lot of his, the little mini-sodes and the sort of the non-aired Doctor Who things that they did on the internet often revolve around memory and a loss of memory. So I think it's fun for him. But that's a great way for her to emphasize how important she knows Clara to be, when she says, oh, I've read our conversations many times. He's setting it up there where, like, she knows she's a big deal. And if she was just like because she's an immortal, because Ashila's an immortal, like, it would be very easy for her to kind of dismiss the death of Clara and say, well, whatever, she was just, you know, she's a mayfly. Why does that matter to you? But they go the reverse way with it, that she understands her significance. And that helps sell that last scene, which I thought they did very well.
Yeah, but I wouldn't buy in the last scene either. Mm. So just because if she did go, oh, dang, then why did she continue to teleport the Doctor? And we'll get into that in a bit, but... If she did believe that was a stupid decision, why would she follow through with
it? Come on, we all want to talk about the ending.
I know, we're getting there. But we're still on our mystery. We're still on our Sherlock hunt, trying to figure everything out and find out this woman, Anna. She has been killed, supposedly. I didn't have a reason not to believe them at the beginning, but she's a Janus, which I'm not very familiar with. Have you seen Janus before?
I mean, I understand the concept of the two-faced sort of thing.
Right.
Tom Baker's companion, Leela, used to carry Janus thorns, actually, which were deadly. But I think it's a fairly easily used cultural reference, you know, the two-faced sort of, but as a race, they've never been seen before. And I thought that visually they look great. Like, it was kind of startling when you see the, yeah, I like that a lot.
Well, yeah, and Riggsy even makes as much a comment about that. Just, what if I freaked and killed her, you know, because they are kind of creepy looking.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I like that a lot.
I think they were kind of going in an interesting direction there. But I don't think he would have been able to tell she was a Janus in that that alleyway because of the worms. So that doesn't, to me, explain why he would have supposedly killed her. But we know he didn't kill her, so that's beside the point.
But that was a lovely character moment, though, when he said, "I don't remember. I could have done it."
Yeah.
But then he says, "I mean, I wouldn't have done it on purpose." I don't know. Just that felt very real to me, like a real reaction, because you would think that, you know, it's sort of like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It was. I liked him a lot in this episode. I liked him in Flatline, and I liked him in this too. And you sort of want him to become a member of the TARDIS team and to sort of to grow and almost do like a Mickey, where he goes from being like a very ordinary person that kind of shows up in different episodes to be a hero.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be interesting to see that. I don't know if we're going to see that unless he is the companion, at least for a couple of episodes or for a season or two. I don't know if he'll be the companion or not without Clara. I think Clara was that glue for him. And I don't know if we're going to see him go off with the doctor by himself, especially with the family that he was saved from. So I don't know if he'd want to go without them by himself, that sort of thing. But for all I know, if the casting direction that you were mentioning earlier was for a certain, I'm assuming a certain melanin in a certain skin level.
Exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. And
yeah, if that's what you were mentioning, it could be his wife and we could see the three of them go.
Yeah. And you sort of, it would be quite fun to have him as like the older, like, you know, sort of slightly made up, and the daughter grows up and he's the older guy, and maybe, you know, cause all you tend to see this in New Doctor Who, that the companion's parents are very cynical because they're protective of the kids. Yeah. Now imagine him, his daughter's traveling with the doctor and he's seen Clara die.
Yeah, and I could see why he would not want her to go with the doctor because of that, and why he would want her to go with the doctor because of what he can do. So there could be an interesting development there. So if we get to that point, it would be very fun to find out what direction we're going.
I feel like we've had a lot of people in this last year or two that could have been companions as well, which is like, which is good. You know, in Last Christmas, the, I forget her name, but the last one to sort of wake up, she does a dance at the start when she's listening to. She was one of them. There were lots of companions that sort of maybe could be, but I think it's more exciting in a way just to bring someone completely new in. You know, when you see that first like promo picture of the new companion with the doctor, and you're like, I don't know who this person is, and I guarantee I won't like them. And then 6 months later, you're like, yay.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. So yeah, we have this kind of setup with the Janus and with what we're having between the characters and Riggsy's just, what if I did kill her? But then we get, I think our first actual death of the episode, because Anna's not necessarily dead, with the undisclosed man. I'm not sure, but the doctor, I think it was interesting at one point, the doctor asks a shielder, could you at least give him a, what kind of death?
I think he says merciful. Yeah.
Yeah, merciful. If you give him that type of death, just something that's not as scary, not as terrifying, and she makes a comment back to him, do you think a Cyberman would fear a merciful death or whatever? And I thought that was very telling, but does that mean the dude who died was a Cyberman?
Well, they're not quite clear, are they? Because it's sort of, again, it sort of reminded me of Classic Who, in that you've got like all these like people that are sort of stand-ins for other monsters. So you've got the cops who are Jadoon, and you've got, you know, you see a Cyberman earlier on, and so I thought that was a fun idea, and it didn't really have time to explore their true identities, but it felt like the episode might go that way, that, you know, some kind of shield gets destroyed and you see all of them as they really are.
Yeah.
But it never did. No. But then that's okay too. But like the idea of like a Cyberman, like having a nice old wife, is sort of quite strange.
Yeah, but they could have been two different Cybermen. I don't know why they would, but you're right. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It's Handles Jr.
yes. But I don't know. We kind of got that little bit out of it. And then we got the bit when he does die and he runs. And then one of the guys in the crowd that we saw a few times already, he was one of the actors that actually got lines this week. He makes the comment, why do they always have to run? And I'm thinking, what does it matter if they run? Why do you care? And this is one of the things that might lead us down a bit of a bunny trail, but I'm thinking, well, we already heard the word retcon this week. Are they going to use this to retcon Claire's death? Is Claire dead? Because she walked towards the Raven. She faced the Raven. And they kind of make this comment about how, why do they always have to run? And I'm thinking, if you're going to die and you're afraid of it, so what? What's it matter if you're running or not? So I didn't know if that actually meant there might be more coming.
I'd have tried to hit the Raven with a cricket bat. That's just me.
Fair enough. We have things in Oklahoma called 12-gauge shotguns. They work really well against Ravens. But if it goes through a door, cricket bat and a shotgun's probably not going to do jack about it.
Six of one, isn't it? But yeah. I'd have had to punt at it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. It's like, I'm not going down without a fight. But yeah, so I don't know. It was weird that he made that comment, and I'm wondering if that's going to come back specifically of how she ends up dying.
But it's not quite clear what they actually do to you. Like, it's like just a Raven sort of going, I don't know.
Well, I think a Shielder says something about how it's promised a soul. So,
which is why I rated this episode less than you, because that stuff is so vague. Like,
I find it
hard to be truly drawn in by that stuff, because it is so, like, it is very Harry Potter. It's very magical thinking. You know, we're transferring the debt of your soul to so and so. I'm like, but that's just, you sort of want the doctor to come in and be like, that's ridiculous. There's no such thing as a debt of souls. Like, how can that be? But yeah, I digress.
Yeah. And you make a very good point. For somebody who doesn't believe in a heaven or a hell, the doctor sure takes the word soul very literal. Or true to meaning. So it's interesting that he couldn't find a way to bring her back to life, like a Meyer device or something like that.
Now, what is a Meyer device?
Well, whatever he gave a Shielder, I'm giving it a name, the Meyer device, because it came from the Meyer.
Right. Well, okay. So let's talk. We've reached a point of no return where we have to talk about this stuff. So he could have given Clara something like that to begin with. Or there's a whole section where he knows she's going to die, and there are probably 1,000 things they could have done.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't. They stand around talking about it.
Yeah. Can you help? No, I can't. He's like, no. Can you help? Like, no, I can't
help. I'm fine. Fine. You go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know. I guess you can't cheat it. But why not?
Not?
And that's the thing, is we have this moment when she's saying, give it to me, to Rigsy. And before that, she learns that she can take it willingly, but you can't cheat death. And it's just like, why not? The doctor literally cheats death at least 12 times.
Lake Silencio. So,
yes, exactly.
He could be like, hang on, I'll be straight back. Right.
Yeah.
I got this. Right. Goes, gets a Tesselector. The crow, the Raven, excuse me. Some Corvine thing flies into the thing, and he's like, you know. But no, he's just like, no, you're fine. So don't forget to give me your key back before you go.
Yeah. And he talks about the quantum shade, the chronolock can follow you throughout time, which I thought was a very, well, he used the word clever, way to say it'll kill you wherever you go, so you can't escape it. They were trying to really give you no way to get out of this in this episode, which is part of what's actually making me go, is this genuine? And, you know, I question everything. Part of me still thinks they're dreaming. And I actually, we've discussed this at length, but my wife was in surgery last week. And while I was in the waiting room, I was writing up a theory about how they're still dreaming. So I didn't publish it, thankfully, because it makes no sense. But to me, it does. And I'm not convinced that everything is as we have seen. I'm still not there. And for all I know, it's Inception, and spoiler alert, she died and she's just on the next level. She woke up.
Mm.
So, I mean, what if they are still dreaming? And I didn't even want to go there this week. I don't like bringing that up, but I'm just not buying this death. It's not convincing to me. It was 90% convincing, but there's this little nagging voice in the back of my head saying, it's not over just yet.
Well, also, there's this idea of, and I hope Stephanie's well, by the way, and yes. This is why I got a text from you saying, Doctor Who and Dreams discuss at like a really random hour.
Yeah. Yeah. It's because I think I was sitting in the hospital waiting room, so...
I'm always happy to. You should always feel free to call, but like what, they're yeah. like, there's no way to stop this raven. I'm like, get a cat, get one of those little windmills. Do you know yeah. what I mean? Like on a,
yeah, get another quantum
yeah,
shape.
Right, exactly. Yeah, like it seems easily solvable. Close the window.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was that idea of like you can't transfer this, but this. But I'm like, it doesn't make any sense. Like again, if this was. I've not seen The Hunger Games, but I'm assuming that's the kind of stuff that happens in The Hunger Games or the later Harry Potter novels. I don't know. It just didn't seem very Doctor Who. It's like, what?
Yeah.
You know, like, there is no... I mean, I know that his TARDIS was, like, locked off to him at that point, but there... Mm-hmm. But I think, as with all of these things, the important thing is how well the actual death was handled, which I did think was done...
Yeah.
Not beautifully, I want to say that word, but it was just done right. Like it was kind of frightening. It was scary. Like there was a little part of me that felt when she's giving the speech to the doctor about, you know, don't get angry, remember me, all of that stuff. A little part of me was like, you know, it's kind of Python-esque. Like you're taking a bit too long.
Yeah. And I didn't really want to dive into that just yet, but I did want to kind of make the point about what you said. It doesn't feel very Doctor Who-y or Who-ish, or golly, I probably butchered what you said. Making up words here on Don't Blink. I think Amy and Rory, when they went away, I had the exact same feeling about them. There were so many ways to fix that he didn't do. It's like, why don't you just go back in time and fix them?
Yeah, it felt like very soft science. And I think part of it is that the actual impact of what happens is colored by the emotional resonance of it. So when Rose Tyler gets zapped over to the alternate universe, what's important is not the way that she gets carried to an alternate universe. That's really not the point. What charges it like a battery is your feelings for the Doctor and Rose. And your real genuine sense of unrequited love. And that makes that the most powerful drama possible. Whereas with Amy and Rory, I felt like it didn't quite have that charge to begin with. And so when you have that sort of slightly spurious, well, I've been sent back to New York, but I guess you've got a time machine, but you can't come and see me because kind of thing. You can do that kind of scientific explanation if there's a real emotional pop to it. And I didn't think there was. And I didn't think there was with Clara and the Doctor either. Although it was very well acted. I just didn't buy the explanation. And it's not helped by the fact that we've had almost every major character in Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who having been killed at some point and then resurrected.
Yeah. It's kind of like the ultimate, if you ever watched Smallville and their version of Superman, and he would get discovered that he was Superman, and they would erase the other guy's memory in some fashion, or his girlfriend's memory. And ultimately that happened, I don't know, 50,000 times for the first several seasons. It was the reason I stopped watching the show, because it kept happening. They essentially kill the character off and bring him back, kill him off and bring him back. It was the same type of thing. And I don't mind that for Doctor Who, because Doctor Who is based on time travel. But it does make me question, when they do kill people off, why they can't time travel. So I don't know. It's they use good paradoxes when they want to use them, and then when they're not convenient, they work around them, which is fine.
Well, I think you roll with it and you turn that to your advantage. So for instance, when Rose, who I'm a bit hung up on, I think as we all know,
yes,
when Rose gets put away to the parallel dimension, there's that wonderful line where in the following season, Jack Harkness says, you know, I watched her grow up from a distance. And that's heartbreaking. It's so, so sad. And you realize that those are the rules, that's how time travel works. You actually can see them again, but you'll watch them grow up and you'll not be able to reach out to them, which is the one thing that you really want to do. And you won't be able to tell them where they're heading or save them. And so that creates another level of like emotional, you know, dramatic impact. But if you spoil it the other way, you get this stuff where it's like, she's just like, you know, what's the difference between this and Missy going pop with the balloon, with Osgood and then having her back like the next year. I mean,
right.
And even the major reviews, like even the really positive reviews of this episode, like in The Guardian and AV Club and places like that, that love this episode, they're all hedging their bets on whether she's actually dead. And I don't know mm-hmm. that's necessarily a good place for the production to be in.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But we'll probably get into what I think further in a moment. There was another paradox in this episode of the keyhole. Why would a stasis machine have a keyhole that fits the TARDIS key? Can the TARDIS key open any lock?
No.
Okay, so bear with me if you will.
I like that I answered that as if it was a real thing.
Hey, I'm just taking what you have it going with it. I've not seen anything that establishes that in lore. But if you have a lock, a locksmith can make a key, mm-hmm. right? That implies that they already have a key to the TARDIS.
Mm-hmm.
So how did they get a lock that was the exact same shape as the key of the TARDIS unless they found a key for the TARDIS and made a lock out of it? I'm not following how they got this lock that his key opened.
And it looked like he eyeballed it and realized what it was. You know, like it wasn't someone's house. Like he just looked at it and was like, oh, that's a TARDIS key.
Right. He just assumed because he had a good reason to assume that, you know, we realize at this point Riggsy's been called there. We know that Anna's apparently a daughter, was told his past and knows the future is clouded with him. So we have what's going on kind of mixed up. But so we know that the keyhole was there for a reason, and the doctor assumes that as well. So he probably assumes it is all about the TARDIS. They make that, I think, obvious in the statement that they make, that it's all about the TARDIS. And then he sticks his key in the keyhole, and it works, and somehow he gets a nice shiny bracelet on his arm.
Yeah, I think at that point he sort of there is a wonderful sort of fatality to it. Like he realizes what's going on, and that yes, he's going to lose the key. Yes, he's probably going to be electrocuted or get a bracelet or something. I did kind of like the way that they played that without a bunch of explanation. Like he just was like, oh, well, great, okay.
Yeah. You know what he did, right? He took the tattoo from Riggsy. That was the exact same thing Clara had done earlier in the episode. She recklessly takes the tattoo. He recklessly sticks the key in the keyhole and tries to open it. It's showing you, I think, and I think that's why they're using it, is to demonstrate the similarities between Clara and the doctor. And then they're going to be conversely demonstrated with the ultimate demise of Clara in this episode, like what happens to one and how they function.
You're quite right. That's exactly what he does. He knows that like he's saving someone's life. And as with Riggsy, like her rationale is, well, you've got a family, which is what the doctor says. You know, you've got to look after your daughter. So that's why he lets her out of the kind of, you know, the stasis thing. I think you're right. That's a great parallel. I hadn't realized it, but thinking about it. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're seeing that parallel there. And I don't know, to me, that's the only reason that entire part of the scene works. It does put on a bracelet, which is brokered. It was a deal that was brokered with a shielder or may or me with an unknown person. Do you have a guess of who this person is?
I'm going to take a punt at it, but I think you and I might have the same idea. Do you think it could be Missy? Hey,
I think it could be Missy.
She's so fine.
Yes, she is.
She is.
She is that. I think that obviously it's screaming Missy. I'll kind of jump ahead, then we'll go back to Clara's ultimate conversation about Clara. But we have this bracelet. They ask for the confession dial. The only person that knows about the confession dial is Missy. And when the doctor at the end of the episode is teleported, the bracelet falls off. And we know from earlier in the season, the bracelet was the reason he was able to escape. So Missy knows if he has the teleportation bracelet, he'll be able to get out. We've seen her with teleportation bracelets in the past in this season, time travel bracelets, whatever. But we have already dealt with this type of technology and the repercussions of the doctor having that type of technology available to him. So I think the fact that it falls off pretty much makes it a 98% chance that it's certainly Missy.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's also, but it, dramatically, it was a real like exclamation point that like he's, you know, he can't reverse the technology. Like the bracelet falls off, he's gone, you know, like wherever he is, he is definitely, his TARDIS isn't with him. He doesn't have the bracelet to reverse engineer. Like it's just going to be a problem. So, but I like Capaldi's acting when he was trying to control his rage. I felt like it was, he could have done that last year when he was more of an alien doctor, but I felt it was more powerful this year when he was a little bit more humanized.
Yeah. We've seen him kind of figure out that he's the doctor that saves and he's going back to the war doctor.
Yeah. And it was almost explicitly said war doctor, like when he said, yeah. And,
yes.
And to me, there was a poignancy for that with this being the anniversary of Doctor Who, just because Stephen Moffat has been talking a lot this week about the war doctor and how he got to that. And John Hurt, by the way, had said some very lovely things about being the war doctor, which I just read today in that Radio Times interview where he, cause I kind of thought he probably just phoned it in a little bit, but he was talking about how genuinely honored he was to play the doctor, which is a huge thing for an actor of John Hurt's caliber to say. Mm-hmm. But, I love that callback. And obviously, you know, hanging out of the TARDIS at the start of the episode was above London is a huge callback to Day of the Doctor. Just as the Zygon stuff has been a callback as well. So I like the way that all kind of tied together. But you do get the sense that the Doctor really hasn't quite recovered from being John Hurt, you know? Like there's still an insecurity there that maybe he's still that person, which I think is very interesting from a character perspective.
Mm-hmm. I think Clara actually said the same thing in the episode The Day of the Doctor with the don't be a warrior, be a doctor bit. I think she pretty much said that exactly to Hurt, but it may have been Matt Smith that she said it to when they're about to destroy Gallifrey. I think so. That kind of ties that together with Capaldi's entire time so far, and then Matt Smith, who introduced Clara to us as his companion. I don't know. So yeah, we definitely see kind of those connections. I was kind of hoping we'd see a bit more with the, like a run clever boy type thing, but I don't know. To me, it was a pretty powerful death overall. Like I had said earlier in the episode, I expected her to die in a arrogant type of fashion. In a way, it didn't shock me. Because I knew that she didn't want to leave him. I knew that she had been saying throughout this season, "I'm not going anywhere." And she's kind of become that doctorish character, this thing that we've already talked before. She's kind of wanted to take that role, and then now she dies. There's only a couple ways to get her out of this situation, and that is for her to be the doctor and to regen, which would blow everybody's mind and probably piss everybody off at the same time. Or if some fashion, the next couple of episodes that she does go away, or she is somehow brought back, not go away. I think it'll be interesting, and I'm still hoping that they do it, that we see Clara at some point in the next two episodes, but maybe not as Clara, maybe as the Impossible Girl.
Mm. Yeah, I think that that's part of it. And bless you, Jeremy, I do try and shield you from spoilers. But I think the last episode of this series is going to be an all bets off type episode. So I think that there's going to be at least a cameo in some fashion from Clara. But I'm fairly sure she's dead. I think that this is going to be a bigger season finale than we've probably had in a long time in terms of like mythos and continuity and so on.
Yeah. But that. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am enormously. I think that the end, that her death was, it was quite hard to process. I mean, it was, part of that was because of these sort of constant resurrections that we've had. Mm-hmm. But we haven't had a companion die in a very, very long time. And there was that weird sort of like multi-camera shot where she was.
I deducted a whole point because of that multi-camera shot. All the issues I may have already mentioned before, I still probably wouldn't have taken it down too much, and other things would have brought me up. This, the screaming multiple times from different angles, and you is probably one of the weirdest things in filmography or whatever that word would actually be. I hate it. I hate when you get to watch people scream three times in an episode because it takes me out of the moment. It really kills that suspension of disbelief. You know, it sets me off. Kind of like the racking the slide issue last week on weapons when you choose to do that multiple times. The same thing with these multi-angle things. If you showed it from different angles and she was screaming like one long scream, it'd be one thing, but you get to see it start over every time. And that's just, it's like something you'd watch at church when they're doing like a retreat video and you're recapping it. I don't know. It's just, it's not good production quality.
Well, you know what it's like? It's like, so there's a piece of music that in the 50s was one of the most extraordinarily poignant pieces of music ever made. And now is just really funny, which is Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. And that's what they play in Platoon at the end, right at the end. You know, when the guy goes down on his knees and his hands are in the air, right?
Yeah.
Da, 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 da. Like, it's so funny. Like, it's just always going to be funny from now on. And it shouldn't be. But like doing that whole like multi-camera like death scene is always going to be funny. We can't not.
Yeah.
And I wasn't laughing when I was watching it, but like you say, you take a point off for it. But I think the thing that was important about that was that she's screaming, and it was well done because you don't obviously have any diegetic sound. You just see her screaming, but then there are a couple of shots where people elsewhere in the camp are looking because they can obviously hear. So you know she's screaming bloody murder, and it's horrible. And I felt that was actually fairly intense.
I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the lack of sound. I liked seeing the others' reactions and not having to listen to her to painfully scream out was, I think, something they did well. It's just the camera shot thing just drives me nuts. So it did, I think, give us a powerful end to her. It was a painful ending. It was not a merciful ending. It was something that her recklessness had caught up to her. Her possible desire to die caught up to her. So I think that definitely gave us a great vision of who Clara was. And she kind of makes the comment of let me be brave, you know, and she goes off, she faces the Raven. And again, like you said, you don't want to do spoilers for me, but you think she's going to be dead. I know that she's out of the season, or I know she's finished with the series. She's done with Doctor Who. But at the same time, I don't know if the character itself is dead of Clara. I don't expect her to be coming back except for maybe a cameo type thing. But there could be a way that they bring her back and then she decides she's done or something like that. That's not what I want to see. I want her to be dead. I've said throughout the season that I want her to die. But there's just, I'm ready for them to call all of my bets and then just say, here's my royal flush. You had a six. That was my high card. I want my high card to be a six because I want them to show me where I'm wrong. But I have so many just doubts because of what the season and what last season dealt with, just with dreams being, I think four or five episodes have dealt directly with dreaming or with controlling people's thoughts. I don't think of another episode since the reboot, at least, with dreams. So why two seasons of dreaming? Something to me, again, is still, it's not pointing to a conclusion, and I want them to conclude her death solidly. And it could just be that I'm reading too much into things, which it likely is. I do a lot of that, but
you and me both.
Yeah. I just want them to show me that they can do something and strongly walk away with it. This isn't the type of show, Inception, spoiler warning, this isn't the type of show that if the top is spinning at the end of the movie, I don't want that to be unresolved for the next 2 years. Because a movie, I can speculate about it and I'm good. It's not like there's another episode that comes after that and then you have to just ignore what you saw before. Doctor Who is, you're just ignoring what you saw. We're ignoring the volcano that he woke up in. We're ignoring all of these details about Clara's death now. Or to me, I'm going to have to ignore them. I'm going to have to put them behind me to say, how did this all happen? And it's still just not, why didn't they try and fix it? Why did the doctor just stand there and say he couldn't do anything? Why did he take their word for it? And for that matter, why did the Shielder even let him stay? Why didn't she send him away? Why did the Shielder let him say, you'll find that it's a very small universe when I'm angry with you? Because he's angry with her. Why not just get rid of him immediately? You know?
I had a real sense that they were desperately trying to get their money's worth out of Maisie Williams. Like, I mean, and so I fully expect to see her again. And Moffat does this thing in his season finales where they bring back a lot of characters that you maybe think you're not going to see again, which is actually kind of cool. So I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. I think next week will be quite a sinister, intense episode, but I think it's the week after that I'm really looking forward to. So
do you know what's actually going to happen? Have you already looked into that?
I know two very key points, which tell me very little. But I think if I told you, you'd be like, whoa, spoilers.
Probably, but I don't know. I won't mention them just for the podcast. I might ask you after the podcast because I'm really curious. Yeah. But I just, do we know what's going to happen? I think Heaven Sent, to me, that tells me kind of where the Doctor's going in a way. He's being sent to Heaven. That's where the teleporter took him. Hellbent kind of tells me he's coming against a Shielder, just with the name of the titles. That's kind of where I'm at. In my hypothesis of where we're going, but maybe there's more to it.
I also quite like that he was wearing a t-shirt with a shark on at the beginning, which we've not discussed. And my wife gave me a little like sideways look, like I can see gonna buy that. And in the next scene, he's got that red velvet like gear on, and she's like, ah, oh, there he goes.
there's another one.
Yeah. So. I'm enjoying this season a lot. I'm very much looking forward to next week, and I'm really looking forward to the week after. Mm-hmm. I know that you and Clara had a little thing going on.
Yeah, I have a thing for brunettes and redheads. You're the blondes. I'm the other two. So.
Well, you know, my condolences to you.
Yeah, I'll make it.
And to our listeners who were attached to Clara, there'll be another one along shortly.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think that we would love to hear from our listeners about this episode, especially like what did this impact people? What did they think about the way she was written out? Is she coming back? I mean, I think that's what is the big question.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity here for feedback, for just discussion. We only sadly have a week to hypothesize what's going on. And at this point, it's probably going to be about 4 days. So not that long, but we definitely want to hear any theories you have on this or even next week's episode, which is Heaven Sent. And you can submit your feedback and theories to 304-837-2278 or visit goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. And again, you can always follow us at Facebook at facebook.com/goldenspiralmedia or on Twitter at GSM Podcasts or at Rogue Oracle. And Oracle, again, has two R's.
And for all of our listeners in North America, I wish you a happy Thanksgiving. Did I get that right? Because I'm new at this. Was that the right wording?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we'll give it to you.
But do have a lovely Thanksgiving. It's the best time of the year. That bit, you've got Halloween, and then you've got Thanksgiving, and then you've got Christmas. So we appreciate your listening. Classic Doctor Who homework is The Talons of Wang Chiang. If for those of you that check in on the old school episodes, it's a very Victorian story that looks a lot like this one.
Are we using the same set?
Same set and props. It's Tom Baker in the Sherlock Holmes gear with the cloak and the deerstalker. And Leela, his companion, carrying Janus Fawn. So there's a few tie-ins there. But six episodes, very good stuff, available on DVD. And let us know what you think about that too. Different times, but it's a great piece of TV.
All right. Until next week, nevermore.
I am the Doctor in Utah, and the majestic tale of a madman in a box are used with permission by Silver Screen Records. They're composed by Murray Gold and performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ben Foster, taken from the original Doctor Who soundtrack, Doctor Who Series 6, available on Silver Screen Records.